This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
And welcome to In Conversation. No Da Vinci codes, but still some hidden religious meaning sneaking in and out tonight. Our guest is Lewis Wolpert, who lives in London, but who has strong Australian links, not least his late wife, novelist Jill Neville. And now he's written a book called Six Impossible Things Before Breakfast, strains of Alice in Wonderland there, and all to do with belief, not least religious belief. He's in conversation with Michelle Field.
Lewis, you've made a career not only as a biologist, but as someone who argues on behalf of science. What I think is a departure for you with the new book is that you want to distinguish between unfounded beliefs and founded ones, ones supported by experiments. Now, my first question is whether there is a gradient, do you think, between these two kinds of beliefs, moving from the wildest superstitions to the most provable science?
There are many occasions when it is either or, whether one really has the evidence or not. But I would agree with you with something I've never really seriously considered before, whether there isn't a gradient. I mean, even in science, some of our ideas, including my own, I can't say I believe in them, but the evidence isn't all that strong. But I think the real point is whether you really care about the evidence or not.
But you also think that people who have superstitions have ignored evidence, or they've used evidence to manipulate the belief they already have?
People love to confirm their beliefs, and so I think that people who are superstitious, who believe in telepathy and things like that, don't look carefully at the evidence, not really. Or they do look at the evidence with a particularly prejudiced view and pick out those things that support them.
You say in the book that scientists have both kinds of belief, in a sense that they subscribe to a religion as well as to the evidence that they need for their scientific research. How do you think they manage this intellectually?
The percentage of scientists who are religious, I think it's around about maybe 10%, 10%, 15%. And I have friends who are deeply religious. And when I discuss it with them, they say, well, I'm sorry, this is what I feel, and I think we can't explain everything, and I believe in it. It doesn't interfere with their science. And I must remind people all the time that Newton was deeply religious.
But there is a certainly in the United States, there is a profile of science and religion being reconciled.
Depends what you mean by reconciled. You can certainly be a religious scientist. It's a question to what extent your religion affects your science. So I think you would be very difficult to be a scientist and religious and believe that, for example, evolution was false, or that's only, I don't know, 10,000 years old and issues like that. So it's where the religion has views which conflict with science that I think the problems arise. But having a personal view about a God who created it all and even made sure that evolution worked, that's fine.
You don't think less of them for having both views?
No, I find it difficult to understand how a scientist could be religious, because the evidence for God, I think, is so poor. But that's not their view. They may be reading the Bible or their own personal experiences, and I don't hold them in any contempt. I'm not against them whatsoever, so long as the religion doesn't interfere with the science.
You also seem to be saying that what is true and scientific is that with which everyone would have to agree once they see the evidence. Do you think it's possible to have, say, a rich and interesting life if one is so strict about what one defines as true?
Well, there's lots of things, and certainly I find it very satisfying that science tells one important things. But so much of it goes against common sense that it's very uncomfortable to live with. When you're going in an aeroplane at 400 miles an hour, constant speed, there's no force acting on you. Force does not cause motion. It causes acceleration, and it doesn't fill you with joy. On the other hand, there are many scientific explanations which give, even like that one, which give one enormous pleasure. But I don't think scientists live their lives, their day-to-day lives, in terms of scientific explanations, no.
I was just thinking that there are so many things that we accept as widely, certainly, as we accept scientific explanations that aren't provable, maybe, by scientific methods or haven't been proved yet. I was thinking, for instance, that almost all cultures believe that a happier life is one that has sexual relations in it. And I'm not aware of any scientists, as opposed, let's say, to sociologists, who can prove this. But certainly it's a...
Well, you certainly could prove it.
Well, you...
could do a survey.
Yeah, but a survey is not a... is
well,
not
it's a good beginning.
It's
yes.
not scientific proof. We could go back through your book and say that surveys are not what science relies
but
on.
But reliable surveys could be really quite useful. No, I have four surveys, but you've got to look at them. There are problems with them, but I think they could provide important right. scientific evidence.
The other problem I have, perhaps, with certain approaches in your book is that you... assume that people who believe in God think of him as perhaps a very, very bright scientist and technologist, one who created everything, and that maybe he's in competition with these lesser mortals who are trying to study his methods to catch up with him, so to speak. Do you think that's the general view of God?
No, I don't think it is. Mm-hmm. I think God is really beyond all that for people who are religious. Since no one's ever seen God, or at least not that we know of, the idea that he's in some sort of competition or he's that human-like, I find extremely implausible. It's something much more powerful, much grander than that. So I don't think there's any conflict, as it were, because God is all-powerful to religious people.
But the intelligent design arguments are coming from that direction, that God is a super scientist in a way.
I don't think the intelligent design people see him as a scientist at all. That I think they see him as a designer, that he did all this. It's not that he understood it, but he's a wonderful technologist.
You mean he did it without knowing what he was doing?
Well, no, he knew what he was doing, and that there are certain aspects of evolution that are very hard to understand, and it's much easier to think that some designer set about making it all.
You begin the book by relating the beginning of supernatural beliefs to the making of tools.
Yes.
And that very early technology and the belief in supernatural God being come together.
Well, I suppose it is one of the central theses of the book, if not the central thesis, and that is that what makes us different from all other animals, including chimpanzees, gorillas, and so forth, is that we have a concept of cause and effect. That is about the physical world. I can put it bluntly, no animal other than a human could play golf. You've got to have a concept of cause and effect of how a ball will go when you hit it. No animal has a concept like that. And another example, there's not evidence for this, but a way of thinking about it. If we see the wind blowing a fruit tree and the fruit falls off and we wanted the fruit, we would know that if we shook the branch, the fruit would fall off. No animal could have that concept. So it's causal belief, but belief about causes in the physical world, and young children, babies, have these concepts very early on. This led to technology, and that's what drove human evolution. We are a tool-making animal. It's technology that matters. Many people argue that really what drove human evolution and makes us human is language and understanding other humans. But as I wittily say, if you wanted to go into the jungle, what would you take with you? A friend or an axe?
But we're not only tool-making, we're cause-seeking.
We're always looking for causes. We cannot tolerate. You see, once people had cause and effect, and the evolutionary advantage was they could make tools and help them survive, then they wanted to understand cause and effect in relation to life, death, weather, everything else, illness.
At the end of the book, I think you make a very interesting case for the fact that technology, for most of history, really was a separate stream from science.
Oh, yes, there's no question about that.
Technologically sophisticated cultures had...
wonderful technology, but no science, yes.
And do you still think that's true, that technology
yes.
and religion are maybe over on one side of the picture and science?
Science had no impact on technology, on our lives, until the late 18th century. The Industrial Revolution had nothing to do with science. Remember, the elephant is wonderful technology. Evolution doesn't use science. Mm. It's trial and error.
In the middle of the book, there's a wonderful discussion on magical thinking, and particularly an interesting chapter on health and the unproven things we believe about our health. Now, I confess, I felt slightly defensive here because some of, I think, the unproven beliefs are intuitions that do gradually, sometimes very, very gradually, lead to science. It's nowadays almost impossible to imagine the time not so long ago when people did not know about genes and genetic inheritance. What was unproven then, that a child is generally like his parents, people might have believed, but they would have believed irrationally. It fit with their experience, in other words, but it wasn't proved. Now, Do you make much allowance for this kind of intuitive belief?
I really don't think that's the way science works. I don't think it comes from intuitive beliefs. It comes from scientists, and it's a peculiar way of thinking. You've got to know the field, you've got to know what's already known, and then try and make another contribution. But when it comes to health and to anything that really affects our lives, our beliefs are very unreliable. And Peter Medawar has this wonderful point that if you've been ill and you've taken something that cures you, nothing can persuade you that it wasn't the thing that you took that made you better. Now, of course, there's no evidence that it was the thing. You may have just got better on your own. And I have my own little joke, if I may tell you. And that is that I can cure flu. You get out of bed each morning and sing God Save the Queen. In 3 weeks, you'll be better.
Yeah.
And I just want to remind you, people did bloodletting for something like 2,000 years before there was a proper clinical trial and shown that it actually did more damage than good.
So you don't think that science is driven anyway by popular experience?
Science is absolutely not driven by popular experience, because science goes against common sense. Virtually every aspect of science goes against common sense. The idea that the Earth goes round the sun, if you look at the sun, it goes against, completely against, and I can give you hundreds of examples.
Yes, yes. But that gives a similar resonance between religion and science, surely, because both of them don't have a lot of common sense to them. You make passing reference in your book to the fact that your son, Matthew, is a evangelical Christian,
yes,
and you don't see much sense in what he believes. You both seem, to me, somewhere more alike in your lack of common sense.
No, not at all. But my beliefs in science are based on evidence.
Yes. Even though they don't make common sense.
Even though they don't make common sense, and that's quite different. Religious beliefs and scientific beliefs bear no relationship other than beliefs, because the evidence for religious beliefs is virtually non-existent.
Can anything you say in a book like yours here, these arguments, can they engage minds like your son's?
No, and I've never been against Matthew being religious, because it helped him a great deal, and he still is religious, although he's doing stand-up comedy now as well as being a teacher. No, but I've never tried to persuade him not to be religious, because it's helped him a great deal. Yes, we've had arguments about evolution and so forth, but neither of us. You know, changing somebody's beliefs is very, very hard.
The purpose of the book was not to put an argument out that would change people's beliefs, only to describe the arguments.
The book's purpose was for me to try and understand what determined people's beliefs, and I'm not quite sure that I do, but also to try and persuade people to examine the evidence for the beliefs that really matter, yes.
I wondered several times in the course of reading the book whether young children who are wonderfully fanciful, and they like cause and effect, but the more imaginative the cause and effect, the better they like it, which in some ways is like scientists. They're not, by and large, generally religious. Religion is something that comes into their hearts, perhaps, when they're older. Do you feel that religion is something that one moves into at a certain intellectual maturity, in the same way science is something you move into it?
To be absolutely honest, I just don't know, but the parents' influence can be very, very important. I mean, I was brought up in a Jewish family in South Africa. I was saying my prayers each night until, I don't know, I was about 13, 14.
And?
Then I gave it up. Well, I gave up religion because I prayed to God and I didn't get what I wanted, so it was purely pragmatic.
Have you stopped praying since then?
Oh, I certainly have never. I'm an atheist.
You write that, quote, "The distinction between knowledge and belief becomes less clear in relation to memory." Some cultures certainly ask people to build more memories than others do. You'd be ostracized in America if you said you couldn't recall anything about your childhood. There are other cultures where if you don't remember a lot about your childhood, that's fine. They don't expect you to walk around with memory banks. I think your suggestion in the book is that if we get used to that kind of false believing with our memories, we can not really be scientific. We cannot be objective about other things.
Well, you're not doing science based on your memory. But there is a particular aspect to a memory defect, a mental illness known as confabulation. And a nice example of confabulation is the doctor says to the man who's in hospital and has a slight brain damage, "Who are these people here?" He says, "Oh, this is my work, and these are the people who work for me." And the doctor says, "But look, they're all in bed." "Yes," he says. "We like to keep our employees very comfortable." Now, the point is that we like to be internally consistent with our beliefs. And if you've got slight problems with your memory, you'll distort the current situation to make a consistent story. And we do this all the time.
Yes. Why do we want this consistency? What is it?
No, that's something in our brains. I don't know. And in spite of all my saying how poor some of our beliefs are, we try not to hold contradictory beliefs. But anybody who's lived with someone else knows that that person can hold two contradictory beliefs in their mind at the same time. Well, I think it helps us. I think for us, if you go into the bush or you want to do something, you want to understand what's happening. So you really need to have these beliefs.
As you say, I think the advantage to have beliefs for early man was that he couldn't change his mind. And changing your mind is a real risk.
When you've learned to keep away from, I don't know, or keep away from the edge of the cliff or the lions, you don't want to start dithering when you meet a lion or a cliff.
These are the two worst things that can be said of the non-scientific approach to life. That generally people are not gullible so much as they're neglectful of the evidence. And they're perhaps too reluctant to look at evidence and admit, honestly, I don't understand.
I think on the whole we don't like saying we don't understand, particularly in relation to personal relationship, what happened. We make up stories. When you go to the doctor, if you get ill, one thing I can guarantee you, you'll tell yourself a story as to why you got ill. You always do. So we always tell ourselves a story or have a belief as to important things that affected our lives. Why one's partner had an affair, why the children are doing better. We find explanations. It matters to us a great deal. When scientists say they don't understand, that's about a common body of knowledge. So any reasonable scientist at the moment would say they don't understand the origin of life.
Or global warming, maybe, or other things.
Well, global warming.
I mean, there are always gray areas around with scientists
I think that we can all say, I don't understand at the moment why I get so tired, but I can make up a story.
But I do think that scientists are willing to be skeptics in the face of things that maybe religious people aren't.
Well, I'm not sure whether in their personal lives. Uh-huh. How consistent scientists are in their beliefs.
So you're saying you can't lead a scientific life. You can only be a scientist in your...
That would be my intuition. I don't have direct evidence for it, no. When our ancestors had these causal beliefs and wanted to try and understand what was happening with regard to illness and death and so forth, the one cause they were pretty sure of was a human cause, because the one thing we understand is we know if I bang you on the nose, I know the cause, as it were. And therefore, gods originally had a human-like quality, but much more mystical and powerful. And this had great advantages, having that belief. It had two advantages. First of all, you had an explanation, and that made one feel better. Secondly, you had someone you could pray to who might help you. Now, I think that those people who had such beliefs may have done better, and therefore mystical or religious beliefs may have become genetically determined. And there is some evidence, even today, that people who are religious are somewhat more healthy than those who are not and have less mental problems. It's not great, but the evidence is there. And I do think that if you consider how many different religions, there's no society, or maybe there's one, all the hundreds of societies around the world, they've all had religion. Now, it cannot be by chance that. It must be, I think, it's partly in our genes. And I'd also like to point out that the evidence that we have something like a mystical mind comes from mental illness, like schizophrenia, where people have hallucinations and things like that. And it's also just worth remembering, you take LSD. I've never taken LSD. But people who take LSD have amazing mystical experiences, religious, non-religious. How can this boring molecule do that? It must be that the circuits are already there in our brains and it's triggered by the drug.
Visions through pharmacology. There are other examples too. Lewis Wolpert's book is called Six Impossible Things Before Breakfast, and he was talking to Michelle Field in ABC London. Next week, the man behind the film The Day After Tomorrow, Michael Molitor. I'm Robin Williams. You're on ABC Radio National, where it's coming up to 8 o'clock.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net, as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.